Welcome to the Commonwealth Poetry Podcast,
where we celebrate poetry and the Commonwealth with people from across the Commonwealth.
I'm Giles Brandreth.
And I'm Afra Brandreth.
We're a father and daughter based in London in the UK.
But each fortnight, we're on an adventure around the Commonwealth, meeting fascinating people, hearing their stories, getting to know 56 amazing and diverse countries, and exploring it all through poetry.
Yes, this week we're in just one of those countries, the UK. And we have rather a special episode for you because we're meeting someone rather special who not only has a strong affinity for the Commonwealth, but who is using his role to strengthen the UK's bonds both within the Commonwealth and with the British Overseas Territories. He's the son of a former Labour Member of Parliament, named after an Australian cricketer, and has a great love of animals, including owning a cat called Atlee. Now, can you guess who this is, Afra?
Well, with a cat called Atlee, I'm guessing perhaps a politician?
Yes, because, of course, Clement Attlee is a former British Labour Prime Minister. And, of course, the clue also is that we're arriving in a moment at the Palace of Westminster. We're about to go into a rather special house within the palace to meet not any old Member of Parliament, but the highest authority within the House of Commons, Mr. Speaker. The Speaker of the House of Commons presides over the House's debates. He's responsible for maintaining order and may, if required, punish members who break the rules of the House. It's a role that, under its present title, dates back to 1377, when Sir Thomas Hungerford was appointed.
Wow. Well, this is definitely going to be a special episode. Let's get going and meet Sir Lindsay Hoyle, MP.
Well, this is a most unusual episode of the Commonwealth Poetry Podcast because we're coming to something, well, somewhere that is very special. We are in the Speaker's House at the Houses of Parliament in Westminster. And the reason I'm laughing is that Mr. Speaker's cat, who's called Atlee, is drinking my water. The Speaker is Sir Lindsay Hoyle. Before we get into the formal business, tell us about this cat.
Oh, well, this is Atlee, who is still a kitten. As you can see, he's not quite got the manners he should have yet. You know, putting his head into somebody else's glass when there's water in, he's got to learn he should have his own glass, not somebody else's. He's part of Speaker's House. He's part of my menagerie. He's here to ensure that we don't get troubled with rodents. I've got to say, since he's been around, we don't have mice, and we certainly haven't seen any signs of them. We do know that they are in many parts of the palace. So we get the phone call and people borrow Atlee and they'll say, can we borrow Atlee for a couple of hours? Would he stay in the office? And what we do know is the clerk of the house had this great problem. He said, oh, I'm inundated with the mice. He said, when I'm sat here, they run across my feet. Since Atlee's been, we've not had any problems with mice in the clerk's office.
Begin by telling us, Lindsay, what the role of the Speaker is, how you come to be the Speaker, and what your job is here in Parliament.
I'm the 158th Speaker, and I think that's interesting in itself. And the one thing about all the Speakers before me, we've all done it differently. We've all got our own style of delivering on being the Speaker. And I'm really, you know, not only is it a privilege to be Speaker, but to be elected by all members of Parliament. And I was elected to become Speaker, the first ever Speaker from Lancashire. And that in itself was a major breakthrough, because this is the North coming and taking over the South. And I've got to say, you know, I'm proud of my Lancashire roots. I'm proud of everything that I've brought to the House since being the Member of Parliament for Chorley. I always say, look, I'm an MP for Chorley first, but secondly, I must have the best job in Parliament, and that is being Speaker. Keeping good order, keeping control of the House. And people say to me, oh, you sit in the chair. Yes, you know, a few hours a day, you know, we sit there in the chair. But it's everything else that goes on in the House that people don't realise. You know, whether that's sitting down like today, the commission, which is like the board of a major company. Because in the end, the House of Commons employs 3,000 people direct. And, you know, looking after the board, whether that's health and safety, whether that's building works, whether that's the pay rise that's going to, you know, for staff as well. All these things come before me. And of course, my biggest worry, and the one worry that keeps me awake at night being Speaker, is security. and ensuring that we have security of the House, but security of members and the people who work here. It's about looking after them that really, really matters to me. And that's what my job's about. So it's being a speaker that sits in the chair to try and keep good order, best temperament, you know, making sure that we see the best of behaviour of MPs. That's my biggest challenge each day, and none more so than on Prime Minister's questions. On a Wednesday, where the big challenge is 30 minutes of pure theatre, as everybody sees, where everybody's trying to score a point, everybody's very loud. But I've got to say, it's everything else that I do as well. So it's this major role, and a role that is a privilege to me, and a privilege that I've been elected by the House, not once, but twice.
Well, congratulations. And we're here in this amazing room, the corner room in Speaker's house. We'd love to hear a little bit about that. And when Dad and I came in here, we walked past some amazing stained glass windows, which I think you recently unveiled. Can you tell us a bit about those?
It was funny because Speaker's house, as we can see, the staterooms are so beautiful. Absolutely fantastic. And you come up the most grand of staircases. A beautiful staircase. Halfway up, you see this great fireplace, beautiful red carpet leading. But you've come through the doors and you see stained glass everywhere, except for two windows. That was very, very odd. And we couldn't understand why there was two plain glass windows, yet everything else is beautiful, it's ornate. It tells the history of what this house was about. We can see the Pugin designs jumping at you, except for these two windows. And asked the question. I said, they've been taken out, obviously. Where is the stained glass? So the search went on. Nobody could find them. What's the story? Because obviously there must have been stained glass window. Pugin never designed something like without. But we couldn't find it. So in the end, somebody suggested that during the war, when the bomb dropped, it could have taken the two windows out. I said, well, that's strange. How it didn't take the windows in front of it or above it is amazing. So then they came up with another conclusion that the speaker's chauffeur at that time used to sit out in the doorkeeper. And by having the door open, they could sit in the chair. By taking the stained glass, they could see anybody who was coming to speaker's house. That seems to ring more true, that this was in the late 50s or early 60s, who quite knows. But what I did know, and the thing that really mattered to me, was about ensuring that we could put something right that was missing. And I said, let us put the stained glass windows. So we went to Birmingham. We looked to Birmingham to see what happened, where the files are kept, on what was in the, and we couldn't find anything. So in the end, we said, look, this is a chance to create new history. And the new history that we could create is, I have this big passion to ensure that the Crown dependencies and the overseas territories have recognition in this house. We pass legislation, we'll pass bills that affect their lives, and yet there's been a disconnect between Parliament and the dependencies and Crown. And what I wanted to was put that right. So I thought, how can we, when you walk in, you'll see Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, all there, all around this building, advertising, but nothing to, as I say, the Crown territories and the Crown dependencies that are there in the overseas territories. And we thought we can put this right. And that's what we did, went away, and John Renton, who's probably one of the finest stained glass people around at the moment, he came and said, I'm excited by this project. I really want to make it happen. We put him on a very tight schedule, and I thought, he'll never deliver. And he delivered. There we are. Of each state, you know, that they have their territory or their dependencies within that crowd. And, of course, a lot of Lancashire roses as well.
Explain to us, for those who don't know, we've heard the phrase, Crown dependencies, overseas territories. What are they? How do they relate to the United Kingdom? And how do they relate to the rest of the Commonwealth?
Well, of course, what we'd say is, with the overseas territories, you know, people say, well, what have we got that's in overseas territories? You know, the fact is that we can go from Gibraltar to the Falklands, from the Pitcairn to Tristan da Cunha. We've all these territories that still exist. In a sense, people say, but that's a hangover from the Empire. These are the people that still want to remain part of the United Kingdom family. And that's what matters. And of course, when we come to the Crown, we're talking about the Isle of Man, Jersey and Guernsey. And they also sit here within part of the United Kingdom family. And that's why it mattered to me. You know, the fact that within Lancashire, we're only one step from the Isle of Man. When I look at a weather map and I see it's raining, I know what rain's going to come to Chorley an hour and a half later. But it is about that close connection. The Isle of Man and Lancashire are very, very close. We have, not only have we got the links by sea, but by air as well. And the fact that people travel between the two. And that really did matter about giving them some recognition. In the same way that we've got Jersey and Guernsey, they're here, they're part of the United Kingdom. You know, they have governors. Same with the overseas territories. They all have governors appointed by the king who sits there to represent the king. They are that head of state. They do that on behalf of the monarch. And what I wanted to was pull that in the same way that, you know, the House, quite rightly, I meet with my counterparts in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, you know, as speakers we meet. So I wanted to make sure that I meet with the speakers of the territories and the dependencies alike.
And do these territories and dependencies have their own governments? Are they
Depending on the size. So there is variations between them. And you know, but when you begin to look at it, Pitcairn, has it got something like 47 people or whatever. So you've got a chief islander. You know, that's what you'll have in Tristan da Cunha. They have the chief islander that represents, and you know, the population there, and I think it's about 350. You know, the fact that the Falklands were talking nearer 3,000, Gibraltar were talking nearer 30,000, over 30,000 if you take the people that are probably studying overseas or working abroad. You know, so you've got the complete extremes of different populations. Within that, of course, we've got the Caribbean. You know, you've got Montserrat, where I've just been, and Montserrat's around 3,000 people. You know, very small, and two-thirds of the island has been destroyed that cannot be used where the volcano was. You know, so we've got these. Who stands up for Montserrat? Who is actually leading on Montserrat? And I wanted to do something in Montserrat that really bothered me, that we talk about, and quite rightly, United Kingdom said, democracy is everything we should believe in. Countries should have their own parliaments. Montserrat got destroyed by a volcano way, way back. And the fact is that that parliament had never, ever been replaced. So I went to the forest and said, this cannot be right. This is part of the United Kingdom without a parliament. And I've got to say the Foreign Office have responded by finding the money to build a new parliament. So the kind of the good things that I can do is to stand up for them and try and put the challenges down to make sure that people are listening to them as well. So I feel that they felt neglected, but I think we've got a whole new beginning here that's going to make sure that part of the family looks after the family.
Well, we can hear your passion definitely in talking about all of these places. You have a connection, I think, as well to Gibraltar. You're Chancellor of the University there.
I am indeed, and you know, asked me to become Chancellor, which I did, and I'm very pleased to be able to take over that role. And that also allows me to put connections back into Lancashire, you know, saying look to the universities, how can we put links and bridges across? But also, having a university in Gibraltar, how can we use that to the other overseas territories, where that will be a satellite university? Because in the end, the degrees they're offering, you know, the blue belt, you know, the fact that we believe in all this marine protection and biodiversity that comes with that, and the degrees that Gibraltar offer on that, the fact they offer on maritime, and all of the overseas territories have got maritime in the same way as well. You know, hospitality, nursing degrees, you know, here we have health degrees that are coming out. All of this fits in to all of the overseas territories. So why can't we join that up? Why can't we deliver that? You know, part of that could be going to Gibraltar, but also it could be that we could have satellite universities. And, we, you know, what I've been trying to is bring those links together. And the Isle of Man and others are keen to say, how can we be involved as well? So I think there's a whole new beginning to help each other and also getting to stand shoulder to shoulder on the issues that matter. You know, one problem is better as a shared problem. And unity is a good way to take issues forward. And that's what I'm trying to do, encourage them to stand up. You know, some of them much stronger than others. You know, the fact that Gibraltar are very strong politically, a wealthy area, you know, great GDP, politically, very politically well, which is fantastic. I say you go to the other end and you know, you go to Tristan Cunha, the most remote place in the world, yet is part of the United Kingdom. And it's making sure that they have access to ministers, making sure that they have access to members of parliament. in this parliament that can stand up for them. You know, that really, really does make a difference. And, you know, we've just had a conference, speakers' conference, that was in Anguilla, that made a big difference for people, where people can share their ideas, they come with the problems. And how can we deliver that? You know, we've seen the problems within Turks and Caicos, you know, some of the policing issues. You know, the fact is that people, you know, there's been a lot of drugs moving around the Caribbean. You know, how can we help support them? How can we strengthen their police to make sure it's dealt with? You know, the fact is that we shouldn't be relying on the Americans. This is part of the United Kingdom. You wouldn't ask them to come and police Dover, so why would we expect them to go and police somewhere in the Caribbean? You know, it's that kind of thing, saying, look, we can do more here. So let's talk to the Secretary of State for Defence. What about having a full-time guardship within the Caribbean instead of 6 months of the year, as though drugs stop for the next 6 months? You know, it's about doing that, giving them access as well to defence. The fact is, we could do a lot of training out there. You know, the fact that we've done training in Belize, we do it in different parts of the world. Well, actually, why aren't we thinking about using Montserrat, a unique landscape? The fact that you've got volcano that's put this arid, like moon landscape at one part, but yet this quite thick, lush jungle that can't be used, would be ideal for training. You know what I'm saying? Luke, we can join up a lot of this, making a real difference. You know, I don't want to be the envy of how the Dutch or how the French do it. You know, when there's a disaster there, the French are ready. They're ready to go immediately. We're 2 weeks away. We can change all that. Let's make and show that we really do care for them and that we're there for them, and we can do it.
This is amazing. Mm. The advocacy, I've never heard anything like this before, for the Overseas Territory and Crown Dependencies. I just use it as a phrase. But clearly, you are the sort of International Secretary of State for the Crown Dependencies and Overseas Territories. Then you have had a speakers' conference of the speakers from all these territories and dependencies.
Absolutely. And, well, it was all the overseas territories, not the Crown. But we had the Crown in recently in here, where we had a meeting, we brought people together. We had a reception, they were part of it. But this was about looking to the overseas territories. And from there, we will broaden that. But it's about giving and pulling the overseas territories together. You know, and we've got 16 overseas territories. And, you know, part of that, of course, is the air base in Cyprus. We have two army bases which are part of the overseas territories, and they were represented here in Speaker's House. But when we did the conference, and I've got to say that was the Falklands came, the fact that we got all of the Caribbean countries coming together, we brought everybody together. I think the only people that were missing on that were Pitcairn, you know, that sadly couldn't come. And of course, as I say, you've got South Antarctica, so they weren't there, and neither was Cyprus.
So obviously we're exploring the Commonwealth, which is 56 countries and part of that big family. What does the Commonwealth mean to you? Is that something that you have connections with?
And of course, I'm very passionate about the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth matters. And, you know, here we have King Charles, head of the Commonwealth. And what I want to see is the Commonwealth coming closer together. Because that is, if you will, if we say the territories of family, they are part of direct cousins. I always think of the Commonwealth maybe being second cousins. They are there and they are part of this great family. And the Commonwealth family, I think, is in itself is wonderful, isn't it? You know, the fact we can go from Papua New Guinea, you know, right through to Jamaica. You know, you look around the world and we have the Commonwealth represented. And I think that is magnificent. But it's also about bringing the Commonwealth countries together, working together, you know, forget, you know, the issues of Brexit, right or wrong. The fact is, we've got a Commonwealth here. We should be trading more with looking after each other, whether that's through business, industry, finance, education. There's so much. There are so many, many variations with the Commonwealth. We need to pull it together and work so more closely together. And, of course, you know, I speak very closely with Australia, New Zealand and Canada, part of the Five Eyes, you know, sharing security. Obviously, India really matters. Big economy, super economy that's going to lead the world. We need to be part of that. We've got to make sure that we are at one and we've got to support each other. You know, you can see the pressures that will come, whether that's from Russia that we've seen within Europe, but also, you know, the fact that China can be a power for good, but also it could be a power for bad. And what we've got to do is make sure we protect the Commonwealth as well. Because what we'll see is more and more interference going forward. And the fact is that the Commonwealth must stand shoulder to shoulder for everything that we believe in. I believe in the passion. I believe in the contribution of all the people within that Commonwealth. And it's so diverse, and that's what makes it unique. We must be the envy of the Americans. They have nothing like we've got. And we've got to work harder and harder to ensure it's got a great future.
And when you have a Commonwealth Speakers Conference, what happens? What do you actually discuss there? The management of your independent parliaments? I mean, what goes on?
Well, of course, depending what it is, it's about the topics of what will come forward. People say, what do we want to see on the agenda? One of the things I always try to ensure is security. Making sure, because we all believe in parliaments, we all believe in democracy, we've got to preserve democracy, a special protection around democracy, how we can help each other, sharing knowledge and sharing the will to protect democracy is so important to me. But of course, it's about the big issues, isn't it? It could be education, access to universities, access to each other's countries, making it able for us to go there and people to come here. You know, and that's something, some of the things that we can work on. But whatever we need to discuss, we can. Environmental issues. You know, we may have some of the greatest ideas, which we do on the environment, but it's no use us keeping them. We need to share them. We've got to share the best of knowledge with each other to protect each other. And I always say about the Commonwealth, the poorest Commonwealth countries will suffer the most unless we get the environmental climate right. And the fact is that we'll see some of those low-lying islands disappear in the Pacific. So we've got to do what we can to help them. We've got to stand shoulder to shoulder to protect them and make sure we're there for each other. And I've got to say, the best of knowledge should be shared, not kept to oneself.
Marvellous. What have you learnt from the Commonwealth countries, or indeed from the overseas territories? Personally, what has changed you, or indeed changed the way you work as a speaker here?
Well, what I wanted to do, we all come into a job, and of course I want to be a speaker. We all want to be liked, of course, but I want to do the right things by Parliament, but also doing the right things by others, and trying to show that we are, without doubt, the envy of the world. The parliamentary system, the Westminster system, is what other people copy. And what we've got to do is show the best of the Westminster system. And I want to be part of that export about good politics, good decision-making, and working with other Commonwealth countries, working with the world in reality, but let's stick with the Commonwealth. You know, it's about that knowledge. I think we can do so much more to shape democracy and help democracy flourish. Because some of these countries, it is still new. You know, the fact is we've got to protect it. It's something I believe passionately. And the fact that I can, you know, get clerks, which we have done, we've got a clerk going out to one of our overseas territories to give them advice, how they can set up and ensure that the executive is held to account. Because that's important. We don't want to see dictatorships. We want to see fledgling democracies flourish. And whatever support I can do, I will. I'm there to assist and help. And the fact that some feel very vulnerable, whether it's through cyber attacks on Parliament, how can we help them? What assistance can we give? What have we been learning over many, many years that I can share that knowledge to protect their parliamentary systems, to protect their democracies? And that's the other part that we can do. We can give advice as well on that. So whatever I can be helpful with, I want to do that. And I want to make sure that we do it well and we do it together.
The adversarial system is very much part of the Westminster model. Is that replicated across the Commonwealth?
Each Commonwealth country, what I always say is the biggest democracy in the world is India. And we're seeing India coming forward with a new parliament, and that's going to be amazing as well. So, of course, we will see the G20 going to Delhi, the largest democracy, you know, in the world. Isn't that a great legacy? Isn't that the Westminster model being portrayed in India? You know, the fantastic that around 1 billion people take part in democracy. That is fantastic. You know, here we have a population that's going to overtake China, a young population with a young democracy. And that's the key part that we've got to remind ourselves. If a country so large can have a democratic system, that's something we can all be proud of. And what I would say is that if you can do it in the largest of populations, you can also do it in the smallest of populations, because it's the one thing that binds us together is our passion for democracy. the passion for elections, the fact that you can have elected government, and the fact that people can challenge that government, that also matters. So it is about scrutiny that really, really matters to me. And that's a legacy that we should be proud of. You know, we could be upset by some of our history, but also we can be proud by the model that we send out there and the fact that we are there to support people. You know, and I go to different countries in the world and they'll say to me, can I say thank you? Your clerks came out, they gave us great advice, they gave us support, you know, and the Westminster strategy is there to help them as well. You know, they're all, we have very passionate people who want to make success. And democracy is what binds us all together. And I think that's what's so important about what we can do is the Westminster model. I'll get to keep exporting it. What we've got to do is make sure we're getting it right here. Then we can say to others, do what we do well.
Oh, your passion is, well, heartwarming. Do you have a passion for poetry?
Because, I've got to say, if I only had time. But of course, one would always say, you've always got to find time. And today, I think we've managed to find some time.
Good. Tell me about your childhood, perhaps, and at school, and what did you learn poetry at school? Who were your English teachers? Where did you go to school? Give us a bit of that.
I was brought up in the village of Adlington. I went to the local school. It's interesting, isn't it? I always look back and think, you know, and people say, oh, wasn't the summers much better in those days? And you always think, yes, they were. I think the reality was the weather was just as bad then. But the fact is that when I went to the school, it was a village, and the village school was filled with farmers in the classrooms. If I go back now, you'd be lucky if there's one farmer's child in the school. Well, when I went, nearly everybody in that classroom was linked to farming. You know, isn't it funny how things change in such a short period? You know, with so many farms around us, of course, they come out of farming and the farm, you know, one farmer will start to dominate and buy up other farms. So that's changed from when I was at school. And I go back now, and it was interesting, I was in not long ago, and to go back, and it's the same old story, isn't it? Doesn't the school look so much smaller? But, you know, one of my old teachers just died recently, Isabel Robinson, you know, and she was so proud that I'd lived across the road from her. She'd see me grow up as well. I was in a class at school. And then for me to become speaker, she, you know, to her, that was everything. You know, and I think it is about that, you know, that I still live in the village. People I went to school with still live in the village. And I think it is about that village life that gives you something different, a different edge, you know. And when I was at school, you know, my cousins were there. You know, it was, in a sense, a family school that all went there. My mother had even gone to the school. You know, so I thought that, you know, it's part of that upbringing, isn't it? A village school, village friends that still exist within a village. It's just the nature of the village has grown so much more from when I was there. But even so, we still have the same families. You know, you still have the same friends. And the fact that, you know, you remember those teachers, you know, I'll never forget, I suppose, in a sense, probably my introduction as well to animals. Mr. Callan was the headmaster. Isabel was the headmistress. And this guy used to breed corgis, you know. And who knows? He may have even managed to do one for Her Majesty, you know. But the fact is, he was very interested in corgis. I think his first was corgis and the school second. But the fact is, I think that's what introduced me, in a sense, to my love of animals, because we used to have a pet show. And the fact that we'd all turn up, you know, somebody turn up with a goldfish in a bowl, you always got one, didn't you? The fact that some would have dogs and I'd take a cat in, you know, and it was always about animals and, you know, living in a rural area and, you know, a farmer would come in with a couple of hens, you know, and it was quite amazing. And somebody not long ago said to me, do you remember this photograph that was in the local newspaper? And there I am on the front row, you know, with a cat. And they're saying to me, oh, there you are. And the Chorley Guardian, you know, said, oh, he may be the MP for Chorley, but of course, his love of animals was still there. And that was one of the, somebody who was at school with me who decided to dig out the photograph. I forgot all about it. But people in the village don't forget. And I think that in itself is very unique. So, of course, you know, having English at that time, English literature, you know, you look back at the books that you were reading at the time in literature. King Arthur was one, and I'm thinking of the book on the otter. It wasn't Tarka Came, the Otter, afterwards, but there was one. Gavin Maxwell, Ring of Bright Water, which was also. So those were the great literary books at that time that, you know, were out there. And you think back, you think, you know, it was quite amazing. And even now, if you look now, I bet the books haven't changed that much. Maybe it is Harry Potter these days, but I still think there were some classic books when I was doing literature.
Well, you've chosen a poem that features a cat, a famous poem.
A very famous poem.
It's by T.S. Eliot. It's McCavity the Mystery Cat. And maybe you and I could read it together, because I was lucky enough when I was a boy to meet T.S. Eliot.
Never?
Yes.
Oh, my word, this is the envy of the day.
Well, it's pretty good going. I used to go to a church in London called St. Stephen's off Gloucester Road, and he was one of the sidesmen there. And I met him at one Christmas when I did a reading in the sort of Festival of Carols, and he came to congratulate me afterwards. And I had no idea who he was. It was explained to me that he was a famous poet. And of course, he didn't talk to me about some of his great poems, but he did mention his Old Possum's Book of Practical Cats, which were poems I think he'd written for his godchildren in the 1930s.
My word.
And you have chosen McCavity, the Mystery Cat. And have you always had cats yourself?
Cats and dogs.
Cats and dogs.
Mm-hmm. We've had a mixture over the years, yes. Usually both together as well in recent years. So, yeah.
What have you got at the moment? What's the menagerie right
well,
now?
Well, we're down a little bit. And I've got to say, tragically, we lost the two dogs we'd had for a very, very long time. So we're now down to Atlee, the cat. We've got Boris the parrot. And we've got Maggie the tortoise. And Maggie is... She's got a hard shell, and she's definitely not for Turner.
So all your creatures in recent years, anyway, have been named after former prime ministers.
They have indeed. And I think it's about politicians. You know, we even had a cat called Dennis after Dennis Skinner. We had Betty, who was named after a former speaker. Gordon, the big Rottweiler, 9-stone Rottweiler. He was a big boy, but had the big clunking paw. Like Gordon Brown used to bang the desk, this dog used to bang your knee till you stroked it. You know, and it's about the characteristics that they show that gives them the name. You know, and they all seem to fit the character they are.
Great. Well, should we have a go? Should we each read a verse, the three of us?
Okay, fantastic.
Here?
That sounds fun.
And we'll let Mr. Speaker start, then you, and then I'll do it. And we'll go round and see how it goes. It's a lovely poem, this.
So we start with McCavity, the Mystery Cat by T.S. Eliot. McCavity, a mystery cat, he's called the Hidden Paw, for he's the master criminal who can defy the law. His bafflement of Scotland Yard, the flying squads disperse, for when they reach the scene of crime, McCavity's not there.
McCavity, McCavity, there's no one like McCavity. He's broken every human law, he breaks the law of gravity. His powers of levitation would make a fakir stare, and when you reach the scene of crime, McCavity's not there. You seek him in the basement, you may look up in the air, but I tell you once and once again, McCavity's not there.
McCavity's a ginger cat. He's very tall and thin. You'd know him if you saw him, for his eyes are sunken in. His brow is deeply lined with thought. His head is highly domed. His coat is dusty from neglect. His whiskers are uncombed. He sways his head from side to side with movements like a snake. And when you think he's half asleep, he's always wide awake.
McCavity, McCavity, there's no one like McCavity. For he's a fiend in feline shape, a monster of depravity. You may meet him in a by street, you may see him in the square. But when the crime's discovered, McCavity's not there.
He's outwardly respectable. They say he cheats at cards, and his footprints are not found in any file of Scotland Yards, and when the larder's looted or the jewel case is rifled, or when the milk is missing, or another peak's been stifled, or the greenhouse glass is broken and the trellis past repair, aye, there's the wonder of the thing. McCavity's not there.
And when the Foreign Office find a treatise gone astray, or the Admiralty lose some plans and drawings by the way, there may be a scrap of paper in the hall or on the stair, but it's useless to investigate. McCavity's not there. And when the loss has been disclosed, the Secret Service say it must have been McCavity, but he's a mile away. You'll be sure to find him resting, or a licking of his thumbs, or engaged in doing complicated long division sums.
McCavity, McCavity, there's no one like McCavity. There never was a cat of such deceitfulness or suavity. He always had an alibi and one or two to spare. At whatever time the deed took place, McCavity wasn't there. And they say that all the cats whose wicked deeds are widely known, I might mention Mungo Jerry, I might mention Griddlebone, are nothing more than agents for the cat, who all the time just controls their operations, the Napoleon of crime.
Marvellous. Great poem. Do you like politicians as a whole? As a breed, you clearly like animals. I'm just wondering, he's so fond of his animals. Is it because he can't stand the people he has to look after?
I think we all have animal instincts for a start. Well, what I would say is, of course, I like politicians. I like politics. You know, I think, I know people think, oh my word, what a terrible bunch of people we are. In general, and the majority of people do it for the right reason, and that's to try and make a better life for all. And that's what I always remember. I always think, I'm very lucky. I'm lucky to be the MP for Chorley. I'm certainly lucky to be the Speaker. But I'm lucky to meet so many politicians as well from around the world. Because politics matter. And that's what I'm really keen about, is ensuring democracy survives.
You grew up in a political family. Like me, your dad was a politician. So you, I guess, got some of your passion for politics from him and your family. But I think you may also share a passion for sports with your dad. And I hear that your name may actually come from an Australian cricketer. What's the story there?
That's very true. Somebody's done some very good research. And of course, you know, when you went to school, when I did, everybody was called Stephen, David, John, never a Lindsay. And I thought, why was I punished? And I've got to tell you, it's a bit like a boy named Sue, isn't it? It toughens you up one way or the other. And I would say, you know, so I said, why Lindsay? He said, my father's mad about cricket. And this opening bat came over from Australia called Lindsay Assett. Lindsay Assett was a fine cricketer. And my father was so keen on cricket that I was named after an Australian cricketer. Could have been an English one, no. I had to be after an Australian. So it always throws the Australian. I must be one of the few politicians I meet that could say, well, I'm named after an Australian. They look at me in disbelief. Well, there we are, and I tell the story, they're quite amazed.
Well, it's a great Commonwealth connection, isn't
great.
It?
Great, and I think the other poem is an Australian poem, is it?
It is
chosen. And why have you chosen this?
Well, my view is that we look back, and we look back at the empire. There was some bad within the empire. There's some good in the empire. But it's about the people of the empire. It's about First Nation people. And I've got to say, to me, this summed everything up about the rights of the First Nation people and their fight for recognition. And I thought this poem really does fit that.
Well, we want you to read it this time, just you alone.
A Song of Hope. And I've got to say, this matters. That here we are, Udagaru, Nunakal, Kath Walker. Look up, my people. The dawn is breaking. The world is waking to a bright new day when none defamers, no restriction tamers, nor colour shamers, nor sneer dismay. Now brood no more on the years behind you. The hope assign you shall the past replace when a juster justice, grown wise and stronger, points the bow no longer at a darker race. So long we waited, bound and frustrated, till hate be hated and caste deposed. Now light shall guide us, no goal denied us, and all doors open that long were closed. See plain the promise, the dark freedom lover, the night's nearly over, and though the long climb, new rights will greet us, new mateship meet us, the joy completes us in our dream time. To our fathers' fathers, the pain, the sorrow, to our children's children, the glad tomorrow.
Oh, that's amazing, isn't it?
It's amazing.
The ending lines are so poignant.
And Kath Walker is the Australian name, whereas the traditional name is Udjuru of the Nunukal. Is that how you say it? And I understand she was a well-respected poet in her time, which was when? The 1960s? A little earlier than that? Around then?
Yes, I think she wrote A Song of Hope in the 1960s. And I believe that it was after realising that there could be hope in a broken world once she'd seen the kind of decrease in racism towards Indigenous people by the English settlers.
Are you optimistic? This is a song of hope. As you go around the world, you travel the Commonwealth, you visit the Crown dependencies, the overseas territories. Sometimes if you watch the news of an evening, which I do, I feel quite bleak about the world. But seeing you today, full of passion, and you seem like an optimistic person. Do you have grounds, you think, for being optimistic?
I do. And, you know, looking at Australia, looking how it's moved forward, the recognition of First Nation people, and the same with New Zealand. And it's catching up on New Zealand, because New Zealand was leading with the Maori Nation and the fact of their rights, the fact that we've seen Australia putting right the wrongs. And there were many wrongs. And it's about being and recognising the history of their country. It didn't start on the day that the ship landed. It started years before, and it's about that early recognition, that passion for First Nation people. That matters to me, but it matters more to Australia, and quite rightly so. True recognition, I think, is coming. And the fact of the respect of the history is so important to everyone. And you can see it as well when we look at Canada as well, you know, Native Canadians, the respect's now being shown, and we'll look into the wrongs that have gone there. And I think it is a brave new world that we're seeing, a new opening within the world, and true respect for each other. You know, whether that is people of colour, that there should be no bar to anybody. We're all equal in a Commonwealth. This is a Commonwealth family, a Commonwealth family that reaches to each other. So yes, I'm full of hope. I'm full of admiration for what is happening. And I'm always full of passion for change that is change for good.
And we are full of beans and full of gratitude, having spent time with you, Mr. Speaker. Sir Lindsay Hoyle, thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Thank you.
And Attlee, where are you? We want you in the photographs.
That's it for this podcast. Our thanks to the Right Honourable Sir Lindsay Hoyle, MP, Speaker of the British House of Commons, who chose to read A Song of Hope by Ujuru Nunukal, also known as Kath Walker, and McCavity the Mystery Cat by T.S. Eliot. Join us next time when we'll be in a different Commonwealth country with more poetry from the Commonwealth.
The Commonwealth Poetry Podcast is presented by Giles Brandreth and Afra Brandreth and produced by the University of Chester. A special thanks to them and to the Royal Commonwealth Society.
And to you, of course, for listening.